Okay. Hi. Good evening. What can I tell you? There was a request, some questions people wanted to ask. You can always email me or yeah, my cell phone number. Ricky can give it to you if anybody don't have it.
I emailed it already.
Okay, great. So if you have any questions, I'll be more happy to answer those. Tonight's shiur is going to present a very rational, straightforward, hopefully conclusive proof that gives us permission to believe that the Torah came from God. It's a big order to do in 45 minutes. We'll see how long it takes, how much time we have, how we do. But let me ask you, what would you say are two differences between Judaism and every single other religion in the world? Two major ones. What would you think they are? The amount of people. So we're like the smallest, right?
No, meaning what the revelation, what we witnessed.
Okay, so revelation, the Jewish people stood at Mount Sinai, and we claim how many people were there?
3 million.
3 million people. How do we get that number 3 million? Well, we know clearly the Torah tells us that there was 600,000 men between 20 and 60. And we assume every man had a wife. So now we double that to 1.2 million men and women between ages of 20 and 60. And you imagine they had a little Chanala and a little Rifkala and a little Moishel running around. So a few kids, we'll say it's a conservative. Some place the number higher, but I'm safe to say that 3 million people claim to have heard God speak to them. Okay, that's definitely one reason that no other religion makes it. What would be another difference between Judaism and every other religion out there? Do you get to go to heaven? Do you have to be Jewish? If you will ask any Christian and you will tell them, I don't believe in Jesus, can I still go to heaven?
No.
They will say to you, Rabbi Jaffe, you're a very nice man, but you're going to hell. Say, thank you very much. Have a good day. I'll ask someone who believes in Islam, but don't accept their doctrine. Now, I think this is true for everyone. There might be the exception of the Baha'i. I'm not an expert. Not an expert in Judaism, certainly not any other religion, but I believe the Baha'i might have a similar doctrine like you, but don't have to belong to their faith necessarily. When 25 years ago, I met somebody who was very, very much, he was Baha'i, and he was very happy, he asked me all his questions about Judaism, but it was a one-way conversation. Like, he was asking me all the questions. I never really asked him too much about his, but I think that might be one. But every other religion, and Baha'i, we would count this one, probably one of the major world religions, but every other religion, besides Judaism, says that you don't have to be Jewish. We believe there's a universal code of morality for every single human being, Jew and Gentile, but we don't have to be a... And in fact, we actually discourage people from converting to Judaism. But that's not necessarily... Those will probably be the two major differences. I want to focus on the first one, what Susan said, that idea about having a divine revelation. So let's begin. You have a source sheet. I'm just going to go through a few of the sources, probably not all of them, but we'll try to analyze this and put it all together. So the first beginning of Pirkei Avos, I think that's officially the title of the series this year, is Pirkei Avos. Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai. Moshe received the Torah from the Mount Sinai. Umosul Yoshua and gave it over to Joshua. Yoshua is Zakenim. Joshua gave it to the elders. Zakenim Leneviim. The elders gave it to the prophets. The Neviim Masula Anshe Knesset Gadol. And they gave it over to the men of the Great Assembly. So we have the very first thing is a transmission. And if you look at the words, it says, Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai, Umosra, then he gave it over. That word Umosra is the basis for the Jewish word Mesorah, which means our tradition. So tradition, the fact that, how many generations do you think, roughly, was it from now, 2019, back to Har Sinai? In the Hebrew year, this is year 5780, and in the Jewish year, 2448. So we're talking about 3,300 years, a little over 3,300 years between an event that we claim 3 million people. How many generations do you say on average that is? 40, 50, 60, 70?
How many generations?
How do you define a generation? I don't know. Although in education, a generation is defined as 7 years. So that means if you're teaching somebody and they're 7 years younger, that's a new generation already. If they're 14, you're two generations away from them. This is what the educational experts have pointed out in terms of it's hard to stay with it, keeping up with all the latest iPhones to know what the new generations want. But we talk about, let's say about 60 plus generations from the time we are now until we claim that our ancestors received it, and it was passed down from rabbi to student, all the way through the generation 60 things over. If you look at the next source from Rav Herschel Schachter Shlita at Yeshiva University, he says, Misora, as we're talking about the tradition, is not primarily a corpus of knowledge to a master, but a process of accessing a chain of student-teacher relationships that reaches back to Sinai. Moshe received the Torah and transmitted to his student Yoshua, who in turn taught to his students and so on, continuing through today. The nature of transmission of the Masorah's instruction from a Rebbe to a student, we connect to the Masorah, to the sacred structures of laws, beliefs, attitudes, through our teachers. So, teachers can certainly be in the formal tense of a classroom setting, but it can also be from parents. Our parents are also our teachers, and we believe. I had a student ask me just this year. He says, you know, in like Greek mythology, they like have stories that have been passed down from generation to generation. Why don't we have anything like that? I looked at this 10th grade boy, and I said, excuse me, my dear friend, have you ever sat at a Passover Seder? He goes, oh yeah, I guess we do have that also. But I can't make these questions, these stories up. So we have that. We have that, where parents tell their children. So if you look at the bookshelf, we have the Torah over here on the bookshelf. And I'll ask you one simple question. How to get there? At what point in time did that book that we call the Torah, five books of Moses, how did that get to be part of our tradition? When did it start? And if we can answer this question, it's all going to fall into place. But let's go slow for a second. What are the different options of how a book called the Torah could have become accepted by the Jewish people? That's it. So how did that happen? Explain to me how that happened.
Well, it's all there in the Torah.
It's all there in the Torah.
Moses went up and God came down and it was delivered to him and written by his hand and through God's word.
And Moses just presented to these guys, I got a book for you. Hot off the press.
So that's one interpretation.
Yeah. Good. So either we got it right at Har Sinai or we got it at the end of 40 years. But somehow a book was delivered to us, right? Mm-hmm. And we all accepted it?
Yeah.
Yeah? Would you accept a book? Would you accept a book that told stories about you that weren't true? No. I don't think anyone, right? So at some point in time, Moshe has to come and say, here's a book relating a experience that you yourself had. So I want to share with you, We'll come back to the idea, but to the back of your mind, keep that open. How in the world did we all just accepted it? Another fun one of what Susan said about the difference between us and them, if you think about other religions, maybe they're true, maybe they're not. But no other religion would make such an audacious claim to say that 3 million people simultaneously heard God speak to them. Let's look at just a few religions. So Christianity was founded by a person named Shaul, who was Jewish. And 35 years after Jesus died, this man Shaul, who later changed his name to Paul, is walking all by himself on a road to Damascus. On this road to Damascus, he gets a visit from you-know-who and reveals himself to him. So what happened? Do we know if he was telling the truth? Was he hallucinating? Did he exaggerate? Did he lie? Did he get confused? Maybe yes, maybe no. But your entire credibility of this religion, which turned the back for a second, I have a little map here of the world religions. See that? By percentages. It looks much more cool in color. I'm sorry I give you the black and white version, but like you can see. How many millions and millions of people are basing their credibility when they believe what one person said? That's what it boils down to. At the end of the day, that's what it is. Islam was founded by a person named Muhammad who heard voices in his head and he dictated them, which became the surah. Now, Muhammad himself was illiterate. He dictated these things to a scribe, so he could not read or write what was actually being written down. So the question is, do you believe these visions in his head? Maybe yes, maybe no. But whether or not you believe this religion all boils down to one human being, right? So Christianity was, that's how you look at the numbers, where it's 22.5% of the world. And we have a few billion people around, 7 billion people. You do the numbers, that's quite large. Mormon, the spring of 1820, right? There was a gentleman named Joseph Smith Jr., who, by himself, had a vision where was this ancient, what's it called? Reformed Egyptian tablets. And lucky to him, he didn't speak Reformed Egyptian, but there was actually a dictionary right next to him. So he could translate the two tablets, and that became known as the Book of Mormon. And he came back, and then he destroyed them, because you don't need to have, like, you know, two Reformed Egyptian tablets lying around. That's pointless. So he destroyed these two tablets of his vision. You believe him or you don't believe him. Now, if all hinges upon this, all these different religions claim that. There is no other religion that could say that 3 million people, they don't make that claim. And any religion that wants to have a shred of truth somehow incorporates into their doctrine the fact that there was a Mount Sinai and revelation there. Yes, God did reveal himself to the Jews, but he like just changed teams. He forgot to tell the Jewish people that, so now he's picked the Christians. And Islam will say, okay, God did do it, and he picked the Jews, and he picked the Christians. Now he's picked us, he just forgot to tell them. So they can't have any evidence with the same degree of historical certainty that we believe that certain people lived. George Washington, Genghis Khan, pick any famous personality, like Julius Caesar. I might not know you, I might not be able to tell you what color horse he rode, but I can tell you Julius Caesar was a human being. We have historic things. With that same degree of certainty, we can tell that 3 million people stood at Har Sinai. But I want to break this down for you a little bit, step by step, to see how we get to that. There's an excellent book written by Rabbi Lawrence Kellerman called Permission to Believe. That's why I took the title for tonight's class based upon this. And I'm going to summarize. He has a book where he goes through this argument. He's been 25 plus years of lecturing on this specific topic. And he talks about we have to be empiricists. We have to deal with what we have in front of us. And we know that we have a book called the Torah. I have to figure out there's one of three ways he suggests that a book could have been introduced to the people where, again, you'll have some very charismatic person who's going to convince millions of people of something that never really happened. So there's one of three ways that he could do that. You could do the present thing. Say, you know what? You might not remember it, but you heard God speak. Present day theory, which would say that there's an event that happened. You don't might remember it, but I'm telling you it happened. They all agree, yes, that's true. We forgot, but now you're right. You remind us. We actually did hear God speak. You know, for some reason, it was like a mental blip or something like that, and now you've reminded us something that happened in our own lifetime. That's one theory as to how you could present a book, an idea, and people say, okay, yeah, that's what happened. Now, let me ask you a question. If I was to make up a story about something that happened in your lifetime, and you didn't remember it, what would you do? You would ask, right? If there's something that can be verifiable, people will seek to verify it. If you tell a lie that's no way to be checked, so then you just have to believe it. But for example, if I was to say, in Kansas City yesterday, there was a helicopter that landed like on the middle of the highway. So if you hear a story like this, what would you do? You quickly Google it, right?
You'd
the real lie. Exactly. You'd want to see, did this really happen or not? And if you asked, I got a cousin who's got a brother who had a roommate who once lived in Kansas City, so I make all the connections, I call somebody who's in Kansas City and say, no, that never happened. Like, I was on the highway and it never happened. So if you're going to launch a story about something that happened in your lifetime and you have people you could ask about it and they tell you it's not true, so then I don't believe the story. But if I call my friend's cousin's roommate's brother's sister's dog and the dog tells me, yes, I was in Kansas City yesterday on the highway and there actually was. It was wild. Here's a YouTube video. I'll show it to you. That actually a helicopter landed? So then if I check into it and it makes sense, I would believe that. So something's going to be launched in a person's lifetime and have a way of verifying that event, they're certainly going to do everything that they can to make sure that's accurate. So that's one thing about it, if they're going to launch it in your plan. A second way, he writes, that you could do it would be not a present day, but to convince people in the past that they heard something about it. You don't remember this, but a long, long time ago, God spoke to 3 million people. Oh yeah? My father never mentioned it to me. My grandfather never mentioned that to me. They forgot, but I'm telling you, I'm just going to remind you of something that actually happened. And yes, the whole collective nation forgot about it, but here I'm going to reintroduce you to something that happened in your collective history, and you know, it got lost. Why don't you know why your parents don't tell you about it? Because they forgot. But I'm reminding you of something. Not that the event happened now in your own lifetime, but that I'm giving the silly example. The helicopter landed on the highway 200 years ago. That's a question, because they didn't have helicopters back then. Okay, you'll work it out. But if you're trying to convince people of an event that happened in their past, there's going to be a breakdown in it, right? And the question is, what happened? Well, it got lost. And I'm here to show you something. I've rediscovered something in your history that you didn't know about. Okay, so you could accept the person, you could not accept the person. And the third way he writes is that you could have not something that happened in the present, not something that happened in the past, you have in a future event. God is going to speak to you, and this is going to happen, so you should accept it now. That in the future, again, if you think about it from a rational point of view, it could only be one of those three things. The book had to somehow be accepted by the Klal Yisrael, either because it happened in our lifetimes, either because it happened in the past and we just forgot about it and you're reminding us, or we believe that this is going to happen sometime in the future and therefore God is going to speak to, and therefore they was accepted, even though I would have chronologically have to place the acceptance of the Torah before it actually happened. Is that clear? Any questions so far? Okay. So he speaks out and he points out clearly as to why each one of these lies could never be accepted. It could never be. You couldn't get 3 million people. First, I can't get them to agree on anything, right? But could you imagine to get them all to convince themselves of something that never happened? Could you get them to all decide we're going to make up a story, agree to it, and then tell that lie to our children? It would never happen. Human nature would never allow such an event to happen. So it must be, if you have 3 million people who are all telling the exact same narrative of a revelation, you couldn't make this up. And it's not just, I believe one person, I believe two people, I have a dozen, 200, 2,000, 200,000, 2 million. 3 million people all claim to have experienced something that starts to think, well, one second, how could you convince that many people to believe something that never really happened? Again, it's the different ways of putting it in. He quotes a person, Marshall Applewhite. Does that name sound familiar? The Heaven's Gate. These are people who, it was a cult. And they committed, it's a very terrible thing, they committed like a mass suicide in Southern California, a little bit outside of San Diego. They had a mansion. There's a whole thing about these black Nike sneakers, and they put bags over their heads. This sounds a little bit familiar. So it's very unsettling. What's that? It's been like, then there was a few knockoffs, and it was like people who were trying to be with them, but they didn't get there. And it was very mythological. It was very clear we went, and they had this thing. And I read some of these articles about what happened. There's been spin-offs, but they believed this charismatic person. And he told lies that were no way possible of ever being verified. Extraterrestrials and all sorts of spooky things, but there were people, I think the ages of them, they didn't allow anybody into their cult under 18. I think between 26 to 72 with the 39 victims. About, there were 39, I think it was like half and half men, half women. Smart, intelligent, successful people, but they all believed in this. And he explains his idea that we'll believe uncheckable lies. That's what this proved. If there's something uncheckable, we'll believe it. But we're not so gullible to believe anything that couldn't be checked out. As you just said, Snopes, right? As soon as you hear a story, you're going to check it out.
Well, we have the ability to do that.
We have, and they didn't back then?
Not really.
Not really? They had no way of knowing this. So someone just showed up with a claim. How did they convince people to pick up the lie?
That's how Muslim and Christianity.
Yeah, what do you mean?
They believed whatever they were told.
Right.
But they weren't told that they experienced it. They were just told that their leader was...
Right, so but how would you get three... How would you get 3 million people to say that? You're right, I can get one person. I can get one very charismatic person.
To say he experienced
it. To say he experienced it, and then either you believe me or you don't. But how can I get 3 million people to tell that?
You can't.
You can't, right?
I don't think you can.
I don't think... It wouldn't hold for anything, right?
We're making an assumption that it's 3 million. We only really know that it's 600,000. We're making an assumption that each of those people is married. There was a lot of assumptions in that number, or no?
I don't think so. We know that they had, I would say the opposite. It's a very conservative estimate. We know that they had children. The Torah clearly delineates who was descended from who and how many, tells the populations of each one of the tribes, so that how the numbers were gotten to. You know, imagine the following. People sometimes like to use the argument of numbers, nonsense of, you know, the revelation. Because when it comes to the case of a revelation, like was pointed out, that there's no comparison. The issue is, well, look at the followers nowadays. Look at billions and billions of people who are following these religions. They were founded by one person. It can't be billions of people are doing something wrong. So there's a Rabbi Daniel Mechanic, who spends a lot of time doing outreach, and he's a very popular, charismatic speaker. And he gave an example of this. He says, imagine you're in a forest, and you know, fire breaks out in the forest, and there's two different roads to escape out of the forest. And you look, and you see five people run this way, and 5,000 people run the other way. So you're looking, you can't decide, which way should I go? Well, if only five people are going one way and 5,000 people are going the opposite direction, chances are I want to have safety in numbers. I want to follow the 5,000. Most people they know what I'm talking about. That would make sense, except what if I changed one factor, he says. What if I tell you that the 5,000 people in the forest were on a field trip? It was a school for the blind. And their teacher was the one person who led 5,000 people behind them. So now you have 5,000 people following one blind person, or you have five people with perfect eyesight deciding on their own which way to get out of the forest. I'm not convinced. I'm not bothered. I'm not threatened at all by the argument of numbers. Is that how many billions and billions and billions of people? Because at the end of the day, we go back to the source. And where did it originate with? It originated with 3 million people claiming something. It originated with one single individual. And I do believe that they could be right, they could be wrong. But I don't think you could get, I'm convinced, you cannot get 3 million people to convince them of a lie and then convince them to pass that lie on to their children.
Can't even get 600,000.
I was going to say, the same logic applies to the numbers that they have recorded.
Okay, fine. If that's a sticking point, I'm happy to lower the number. But I think, clearly, once you just make the calculations, realize it wasn't isolated only 600,000. It tells you clearly it was just men between, right, 20 and 60. And let's be honest, if there's a next generation, that means there are women there also, right? So then we've just basically doubled our numbers. And then they did have kids, because the Jewish people continued, right? Now, am I going too fast, or these points? Okay. I mean, I'm just looking over some things I took notes down.
There's no other religion that does this?
No other religion claims that millions of people had a divine revelation. Every religion will have what's called their revelation narrative. How God spoke to their founder and their doctrines, and that's what this is now what we believe. But whether it's Paul, whether it's Muhammad, whether it's Smith, whatever these people are, at the end of the day, you either believe them or there are some that have a small group of people that they all claim to have. Yes, this is not class. You don't have to.
Is there more than one recording? Because there's only one. You're saying there's 600,000 people who had it, but they're not all recording it. There's only one recording.
Right, but they all accepted that account.
But there's only one official passing down, just like there's an official passing down.
But it's passing down about themselves. The original 600.
Right.
600,000.
600,000. Accepted that about themselves. It's not one person saying this happened.
And then they multiply out and then write it down.
That generation, but their children. Their children were alive.
I know what you're saying. Only one person. Moses. There's only one written down account of the 600,000. It's not 600,000 separate accounts.
Right, but if that account says that 600,000 people witnessed something, good. Make the counter argument. Let's talk it out. But if 600,000 people,
maybe he made up the story.
But the time was written. The whole story is written. They died out.
Why did they change it?
Yes, but that was only people between the ages of 20 and 60. The 19-year-old who was there also lived. The 61-year-old who was there lived. Though that was that generation did die out. It was a new generation that went into. But how did that generation that came in there, so where did they get the story from? Where did this account come from that goes back 60-plus generations? You know, if not, you know, when they have these hypothesis theories, like there's like four different authors, and there's the Book of J, and there's the Book of E, and someone came and redacted it. The quote-unquote biblical scholars themselves can't even agree as to what the theory is, as to how this book got launched and accepted. Rabbi Kellerman has in one of his talks, he says, imagine the following, if you want to give a natural explanation for what happened, so that makes the question even so much more stronger. According to the laws of nature, I'm going to use his example. I don't have the mathematics exactly, but he said like this. Let's say a person tells you, I'm going to roll a pair of dice and get double sixes. So what's the probability of throwing two dice and getting double sixes? 1 out of 36, right? 1 out of 6 on this, 1 out of 6. 1 out of 36. So you get double sixes. And he says, you know what? Not only am I going to throw double sixes now this one time, I'm going to throw double sixes 10 times in a row. And he does it. And he quoted a number that was, believe me, was astronomically large about what the probabilities are of throwing double sixes, right? Because it's 1 out of 36 chance that he got it. It's 35 out of 36% that it's rigged if he can do this. So then, if you do it 10 straight times, so the probability that that could actually happen, quote unquote, naturally, are, again, the number's like 10 to the blah, 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 blah. And the chance it was actually rigged, that it was all a big hoax, then that's why he's throwing the double sixes 10 times straight in a row, so that probability was extremely large. So when it came out, and he said, imagine if you did this for generations after generations, what would come out as follows is you'd basically have a small chance this person was actually throwing the dice with skill or with luck. That comes out to be a .0.0000000.1 chance that guy's actually doing it. And what the chances are that he's actually is rigged, it's 99.9999999999997% that actually something's in him. So I'll read you what he said here. He said, if this was actually normal, if it was a natural thing that God would have revealed himself to a people, then in the last 6,000 years it should have happened again. The rule of nature is that natural things repeat themselves. Right? I have this. I pick it up. I drop it. It's going to keep falling. It's going to keep falling. The sun's going to keep shining and rising because that's a natural event. Natural things reoccur. Things that are not natural do not reoccur with frequency. So why have we heard this again? If you have a natural explanation for this, why hasn't there been the last 6,000 years any other civilization, any other religion, any other people have gotten up and made such a chutzpah claim to say that God spoke to millions or 600,000 people at once? Why hasn't nature repeated itself? And the answer is because it's not natural. But from a rationalist explanation, there's no other way of explaining it. You could not launch the theory. You cannot convince them. You only have three options. You have the past model, that something happened years and it got lost, and now I'm here reintroducing it to you because I'm this charismatic person. You have the present day model, where the charismatic leader says to them, you all experienced this, you don't remember it, but I'm telling you it happened in your own lifetime. Or the future one, that it's going to happen, therefore you should accept it now. But none of these theories could have actually produced what we have nowadays. You can go and you can find historical, archaeological evidence for the Jewish people being in Israel 2,000 years ago. How did that happen? Like, where did that come from? And we start off by talking about Masorah. The opening Mishnah in Pirkei Avos talks about how Moshe gave the Torah and passed it on to Yeshua, passed on to his students, to his students, to his students. We have documents from independent sources who can talk about who was a student of who. From our generation, the Rambam lists 40 generations in a row of who learned from who. I could tell you who my Rebbe was and who his rabbi was and who his rabbi was. One small example from Shlomo Volpe was the Rebbe of, I think, of Lawrence Kellerman, who was giving this talk. So, and who was his Rebbe? I could tell you it was Rabbi Yerucham Lavovitz. And who was Rabbi Yerucham Lavovitz? Rabbi Simcha Zissel. And who was Rabbi Simcha Zissel? Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And who was Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's Rebbe? Rabbi Zundel of Salan. Who was his Rebbe? Rabbi Chaim Volozhin. Who was his Rebbe? The Vilna Gaon. And all of a sudden, we've just gone back 200 years. And we have, from student to teacher, we could trace this back where it came from. Who convinced them? Who started the ball rolling? Who convinced the Vilna Gaon? Genius of geniuses. Who convinced them to believe this lie? Generation after generation after generation. Unless it's actually true. Unless this really happened and people believed it and passed this down. And the next year after it happened, they gave over a Passover Seder and said, this is what we experienced. Yeah, question?
Yeah.
Sure.
We don't really know who these men were, and it was that's where it gets kind of cloudy, and they did kind of lose track of some of, like, after the prophets before.
So the men of the Great Assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, was a transitional period. It ended the period of prophecy. So we have prophets like Malachi. He was both a prophet and a member of that, and it also began the time period of the Tanoim, those the authors of the Mishnah, the authors of the Medrash, the authors of Tosefta, that time period as well. So could we identify exactly who each person was? That I don't know. We could definitely know who the Av based and who the leader was of each court in that time period. That's the Rambam tells, and who was the major leader of the Jewish people at that time. I could tell you who Ezra was. I could tell you who Yehoshua was, who Joshua was. I could tell you who Mordechai was. We could tell you who the leaders were of the Jewish people in every single generation. Can I tell you who exactly made up the other 119 people on the thing? Maybe not. But I don't know. We, and when we have people, we can identify which generation they lived in. This person was a third generation Amora. This was a fourth generation. Where we're able to do that. I think when all the dust settles, it's not hard. It's not hard to believe with a very rationalist, imperial knowledge that this is true, that this really happened. And when that moment, when that intellectual reality clicks and people connect and understand that this is true, that God gave the Torah to the Jewish people, that's one of the most powerful, inspirational moments in a person's life. The challenge is not believing in it. It's very easy. But what that means, and the psychological revolution that happens once that kicks in, is I might have to change my lifestyle. If there really is truth in the world, and God has clearly made it known to human beings what He expects from each one of us, that shakes me out of my comfort zone. And I don't know if I'm ready to accept that. So I can give a lot of different answers, I give a lot of rationalizations, I can give a lot of different excuses. But at the end of the day, if the Torah is true, that creates an obligation on what type of lifestyle, what type of moral code. It's not an ownerless lifestyle anymore. I'm held responsible and accountable for my actions. And I might want to behave in a certain way. I might want to harm people. I might want to steal. I might want to be dishonest. But at the end of the day, I know that I'm held accountable. There's a higher moral code to what we're thing. It's not hard to find the truth. That's not the hard part. The hard part is the courage to lead a lifestyle based upon the truth. And for each one of us in our own spiritual journey, we have to figure out what we're prepared to accept, and what there's some dissonance, some pushback. But I think it's very clear. And again, there's many more books on this who present much more eloquent arguments than I did tonight about the truth of it. And the book he writes, Permission to Believe, that you're allowed to believe that God revealed Himself. There's nothing wrong. And even from a strict scientific, logical point of view, one can come to this conclusion. And if anyone has any other theories, I mean, he's talking about some of these crazy theories about how people believe that they got the thing. See, the Jewish people left the Egypt, and they ran out of food. So what did they have in the desert? They had mushrooms. And the mushrooms were hallucinogenics. So you had about, 600,000 people on one big acid trip. Gaval, they all talk. Because, I mean, come on. Would these people be normal? They all had the same trip. They all had the same experience. Was there
any mushrooms?
No. Another theory. Wait, another theory. So Abraham offered to sacrifice his son. What normal person would ever sacrifice his son? It's not normal. It must be that he was crazy. And his son was 37. Isaac was 37 at the time of the binding, the Kedus Yitzchak. What 37-year-old would stretch out his neck to offer to be bound? Must be he was also Gorma Shugana. He was crazy. And the problem is, there's a genetic default. Because Abraham had genetic genes passed on to Isaac. And therefore, they spawned a nation of millions of Jews. There's now, how many Jews are there? Millions of Jews. We're all genetically deformed because we come from Abraham. That's why we believe such things. The problem is we have the highest level of Nobel prizes, so we're like genetically deformed, but we're winning all the Nobel Peace Prizes. What's that? Shmuel's also from there, right? So there's more. These are theories that are floating around in higher academic circles right now. But between me and you, it's not worth the paper that's written on. But these people are trying to give all sorts of crazy explanations because they can't face the truth. It would. Shake up the core of their existence if actually the Torah did come from God on Har Sinai, and they're not willing to do that. So they'll make up these acid trips, these genetic types of silly explanations to try to give anything, grasping at straws, any other documentary hypothesis, which is holes in it. These things are foolish. The people are willing to believe foolishness in order to prevent them from having to make a lifestyle change. And, you know, there's much more to talk about, but I just wanted to present the key points of the idea. Are there any questions?
I have a question.
Sure.
Can you just address how it has progressed and what the evolution has been? The Torah is the Torah. It's written. It is what it is. But are there accommodations? Things have changed over the 3,000 years.
Right.
So how does that affect?
It's an excellent question. The Torah doesn't change. The Torah adapts. The Torah has given us guidelines and rules, and what we need to do is to figure out how to apply modern day questions to the guide, to the eternal guidelines of that. So there's a case, I don't know if I talked about with this group, maybe a different occasion. The Talmud talks about that there's something called impurity. If you have a dead body, so you're not allowed to become in contact with a dead body, makes you ritually impure. So the rule is, the halacha is, not only does the dead body travels upward from the grave. So imagine this is the grave. So the person's buried here, it spreads up. So we're going to ask the question, what if I'm standing on one side of the grave and I want to jump from one side of the grave to the other? Can I do that? He says, no, because you passed over the, right? The impurity goes up. Okay, says the Gemara, I got a new question. What if I put somebody in a box and I take that box and I throw him in the box from one side of the grave going in the airspace over to the other side of the grave? Okay? So you and I are sitting learning this piece of Gemara for the last 1900 years, and we think that's pretty silly, putting someone in a box and having them throwing them over a grave. And they created something called an airplane. Yeah? So now we have to go back to the Torah and understand, well, what are those rules? What was that case that seemed so obscure, so irrelevant? And now it makes them, well, does LL have to change their flight patterns or not? Because now we have people in boxes who are flying over graves. So that's one example off the cuff of something where the Torah doesn't change, but the Torah gives us the rules. And our job, we have to have a mandate. We have to apply the timeless wisdom of the Torah to today's modern times. So that's the tightrope we walk, but it's definitely doable.
And do we all do that in the same manner? I mean,
okay, there are rooms where there's open for interpretation. Again, certain within Jewish law, you have people who are qualified to give opinions. There are different opinions. Not everybody who speaks is qualified. That would be maybe a topic for maybe next month, as to who's qualified in Jewish law to give an opinion. Not everybody who has a blog, you understand, is qualified to. But people don't realize that.
Those people who were qualified,
there. Right, 100%. Even amongst those who were qualified, we talked about the 120 rabbis. So even there was differences of opinion. But they, again, I want to make a key point. They were all qualified. Now, in the age of blogging, we just quoted earlier from Rav Herschel Schechter. So you have him and you have some no-name who can't read Hebrew without the dots. And they both have the opinions. So you Google on the internet, what does Judaism say about this? I have Rav Herschel Schechter and I have you-know-who doesn't know anything. Must be the same playing field. One's a mountain, one's a mosquito. But we have to understand who's who and who's entitled to that. Okay.
I know yeah. you have to start prayer soon, but... your wife has the opportunity of being your wife, so she could give arguments. I just wanted to see if there's anybody else who is, I don't want to put anybody on the spot, but if there's something that you want to give the devil's advocate or a question that you have in your mind.
That threw me, what you said. Now I'm confused. Because you're right. One person reported it.
Right, who's to say that there were 3 million people there?
Only Moses reported it.
Right.
No, I'm not trying to go through the zoo, but I'm saying I just want to make sure everyone...
Who let her in?
I just want to make sure it's clear. Any other questions, like this is the time to ask. Quickly.
I do have a question, actually. Is there any exactly. So, if it's the case that Moses did write this all down, and, you know, it's also speculated that Joshua wrote down Moses' death, whatever, you know. But going into the future, after Moses died and Joshua died and all that, like all the prophets and everything, who wrote all that?
Well, the Gemara tells us exactly who wrote each one of the books, the prophets. And in the book of the last eight verses, it says Moshe died, and there's eight more verses in the Torah. So there's a discussion, two different opinions, as to whether Joshua wrote the last eight verses or Moshe wrote them. It says he was crying. He was crying as he wrote about his own death in the Torah. Again,
that question. Let's put on pause because we can talk about that in discussions. Is there any other questions or arguments or something that doesn't sit well? Let's verbalize them now. We might not be able to get through all of them, but let's. Is there any other?
That's fine.
I don't know. I mean, my only observation was that there was something a little unsettling about the fact that other religions. only had one person where they received a revelation in comparison to what we had. And it kind of, I guess I was left with, like, you know, that we had this feeling of superiority type of thing. And I guess there was a little bit of an unease. And that, I mean, is it, I guess I questioned that the other religions, they don't, really don't have anything to confirm and to establish and prove that they're legit. Kind of like what we do.
But that comes from that.
No.
That's what they say, that JC and then Paul, they're saying it.
Right, and the, but there's no proof that for them too, like Jesus Christ was legit. He was, I mean, like that he or other.
They'll tell you as follows. It boils down to one thing: either you have faith or you don't.
Yeah.
That's what it, that any believing person of another will tell you. This is my faith. This is what I choose to believe. Okay, so you're basing your entire credibility on one person, whether you believe them or not.
Mm-hmm.
Now again, despite I love my wife, I'm going to disagree with her. It's not one person. It's not one person. You could not get the millions of people to agree to something that they didn't self did not experience. And even though one person wrote it down, what?
So somebody like now, somebody would have written against it.
Correct.
That
happened to me. And anybody in that generation would
have
said that.
Imagine had some crazy guy. Imagine had some crazy guy, not your husband, some other crazy guy, and he just shows up with a book and says, "Hey, I meant to tell you all about this. Now, you don't realize, but here's a book that says what happened to 3 million people. Who, what, when, where, how? Oh, you're telling me a story that happened to me and about everything? Okay, I'll just pass that on." You wouldn't get one guy comes along with a crazy story. You're not going to believe that one guy. You're not going to believe the one guy who wrote it. Yes, Moshe recorded it, but he's recording that. You could not have launched a lie like that. It won't get off the ground. Yes, on a technical point, my wife's correct. She's normally correct.
She's always
correct. But then, come on, I mean, let's be honest. All right, we're going to talk Marv now. But the end of the day is like this. One person was recording a history of millions of people and nobody said boo. They wouldn't have given that over. They wouldn't have repeated something that they, unless they really believed in it. If someone comes up with a crazy story, so let him tell his crazy story. But we're the millions of people who adapted that crazy hallucination, whatever word you want to use to it, it could never have gotten continued beyond if there wasn't truth to it. It couldn't.
I guess the last question for a different time here to discuss is, if one person had a story and then one person recorded and everyone believed them, why is there only one person recording with 3 minutes? Why wasn't there more recordings of it?
Right.
That's the follow-up question.
Okay.
Why 70 people?